singing with us, church family. My name is Dan. It is my honor to serve as pastor here, and we will be hearing a main message today out of the Bible. We're in the book of James. So much happens in our lives, it's hard to keep track of it all, and I came across a friend of mine this past week who was expressing publicly that his parents were troubled because they had a house fire over the holidays and burned down a massive portion of their home. And then the trouble was even more complicated in that 13 years ago this month, they had their first house fire. I mean, what are the chances that anyone has one house fire, let alone two? And it occurred to me that this is the kind of trouble that people face over the years and over the course of their life, that for some Christians, this is the kind of trouble that triggers them to give up on their faith, to abandon their faith, and that their faith is abandoned because they come to believe that since this kind of trouble happened to them again, that God cannot be real, because if he was real, he wouldn't have let it happen. He can't be good, because if he was good, he wouldn't have let it happen. And so they start to convince themselves that based on this trouble, God can't be at work. He can't be real, or he can't be trusted. And it triggers some who are troubled by experiences like that to abandon their faith, to leave and walk away in essence from their faith. But when you understand the scriptures and you understand the way that God has revealed himself, here's what we discover: that the world that we're living in currently is fallen, broken, and that fallen, broken, evil world is damaging our lives. It will, if it hasn't yet, damage your life. And brokenness, betrayal, and all kinds of affliction that lands in our lives are different from the consequences that come to us based on our unwise decisions. So when we talk today in the book of James about trouble and trials, here's what we're not talking about. We're not talking about the kind of turmoil, chaos, confusion, and drama that comes to us when we make unwise decisions. In other words, most of us have probably had a conversation with somebody who is agonizing over the trouble that they're facing in their life, but when you listen to them tell the story, you realize it all started when they bought their dream car on a credit card. And now their credit score is so, do you know that some of you physically winced at that? Isn't that amazing? I said, bought their dream car on a credit card, and I saw some of you, ugh. And then someone's describing to you the trouble they're now facing and the affliction that's befallen their life because their credit score is too damaged to take a mortgage for a home. So I'm not talking about the consequences of our own kind of selfish or unwise decisions. Do you know how everybody kind of has some kind of trouble in their life, but it's based on some knuckleheaded decision that they made in their life? Or maybe some lack of wisdom. That's not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the trouble. James refers to this as trouble or trials that come our way that are circumstances out of our control. Things that we don't really have any control over that are happening because our world is fallen, broken, selfish, rebellious, and otherwise loaded with evil. These troubling circumstances that kind of befall us, here's how I've kind of categorize them in my mind to think of them. I kind of come up with six D's that these categories of trouble fall into, starting from with the word depression and all of the things related to somebody physically experiencing depression and the trouble of disruption. Disruption would be something that happens to our family. And then you might think of another category called disaster. The house fire of my friend, that would be a disaster. Flooding or other circumstances beyond your control, right? Then we have disease or a diagnosis that's a category of all kinds of trouble that some people are facing in their life. And also the category of divorce and death, which would make room for the trouble of very, very intense internal stress and strain coming from these six D's of trouble. So that kind of gives you an idea. And here's what I'm discovering, that the truth that is revealed to us in the book of James, if you grab it, embrace it, hold on to it, if you really believe what you're going to learn out of the book of James, God is going to help prevent in your life a lifelong a life of frustration and a life ultimately full of bitterness. Imagine this. Imagine that if you believe, if you embrace and believe what we learn in James, the way that God has revealed himself, that when you're facing the kind of trouble that our lives bring to us, it'll save you from a life of frustration and a life ultimately of bitterness. Worst case scenario, so much hardship that you're facing that it drives you far from God and you spend your life now and for eternity separated from God, because that's what occurs, that's what happens when people cannot or unable to process the trouble they're facing the way that God describes we could and we should. So if you grab this today, and this might be specifically for someone today who's thinking of giving up on their faith. This might be for someone today who is thinking of restarting their faith, and you're gonna realize that what you're facing in your life that has pushed you to consider restarting your new faith in God as a result of God at work redeeming that trouble that you're facing, or using that trouble, leveraging that trouble that you're facing. So we're gonna be in a series on the book of James. 10 weeks in a very practical book on how to live out your faith. And in your notes here, the handout had a poster, which is from the Bible Project. Love this group, follow them, support them, and use their resources regularly. Here's an overview of the book of James. If you wanna know where we're headed and how we're gonna look at the book of James, it's all animated right here. Also great family worship if you have kids and you're trying to teach them and talk through some of the Bible with them. This same poster is in the church app. If you click on Sunday messages and then you click on notes, you'll get a digital version of this that you can keep with you as you're filling in the handout there digitally. Also, I wanna make sure that you know that we have a Grow On Your Own resource that you can buy for what it costs us. And if you pick one of these up, follow along with us. This is what we're reading and studying on Sundays. So a lot of what you need to kind of deepen your insight and go where we don't have time to go will come right through that book. So help yourself to the welcome wall, and you can buy that at the iPad out there. And we're grateful for these great resources and insights. Now, the book of James is written by James. I mean, imagine if you didn't come here today. Can you even imagine the ignorance? James wrote it. Who is James? James is a brother of Jesus. James is a leader in the church. And James is writing specifically to the church that has been scattered abroad. He refers to them as the 12 tribes. And what he's doing here is he's saying the 12 tribes, similar to the 12 disciples, represent that the old church of the Old Testament, God's people, have been scattered, and he has 12 disciples that represent the 12 tribes pulling together the New Testament church and the Old Testament people of God, saying these are the same ones and they're being identified as the same church, the new Israel in the New Testament. And he writes specifically to people who have been persecuted, and they've been persecuted so intensely that they've left their homes, they've left their homeland. They are scattered into different portions and places in the Mediterranean world. How did this happen and why did this happen? Imagine if you would. If I were a young, hip pastor, I would be presenting this with a watermelon up here and a big old sledgehammer. But I'm not, so you're gonna have to imagine this. You're gonna have to imagine this sledgehammer hitting this watermelon, and the first thing that you're gonna notice that happens to the watermelon is it explodes and disperses into all kinds of pieces. This is literally what happened to God's people, the Hebrew people, as the regimes, the tyrants and the wicked kingdoms of Assyria and Babylon came crushing down onto God's people, and it pressed them so violently that they scattered and left their homeland. So they aren't gathered in a nation called Israel. Israel, the people of God, are all over in different house churches. And James is writing them. And James is telling them, it is possible, even though you faced what you faced in being displaced from home and being exiled and dispersed and scattered abroad, it's still possible to live your faith. No matter what you're facing in the hardship and the persecution, it's still possible. In fact, you're still responsible to live this faith out in reality, not just in theory. And it helps us understand what they're facing, these house churches that are outside of Palestine are distinctly Jewish, and he's writing to people who are suffering persecution and living in poverty, who have decided that for whatever reason, whether they're distracted or they decided to set aside their faith that came from their forefathers and kind of tackle and tread the difficulties of life separate from the faith that they were given by their father. So they are on their own, self-reliant, independent from God, and James is trying to say, hey, listen, I'm gonna correct this, and then I'm gonna challenge you. And that's what we'll find in the book of James, is correction and challenge. It'll be specific, it'll be detailed, and basically he calls for them and he challenges them. Live a life that's wholly devoted to God even when you're facing trouble. And let that trouble cause an even greater source of maturity and depth and dependence on God who created you and the God who saved your soul. So while James isn't going to introduce a new theology to us, what he's going to do is he's going to challenge believers on how you and I should live in a world that's broken, a world that's fallen, full of evil and rebellion and all kinds of other painful, painful circumstances. So he teaches us what's the right way to live when everything has gone wrong. Our business, family, marriages, parenting, careers, when things are off the rails, James is teaching us how then should we live even in the face of all of that trouble. So here's the summary theme of the book. You can follow along on the screen behind me. The message of James is that those who have been truly saved, people who are really born again, they really belong to God, that they must manifest that salvation. There is an outflow, an outworking, that real faith has real work. It demonstrates itself. There is fruit to it in practical ways that express themselves in their life. So finances, career, family, relationships, the way we talk, all that those specifics are deeply and heavily changed by the way that God has changed us, the way that he has transformed us in saving our soul. So we see here that he will use the book of Proverbs, he will use the wisdom of Jesus, his brother, and all of these wise teachings and sayings that he uses lead to him basically creating for us another book of wisdom literature, another book where we can turn to and find how to navigate all of the difficulties that life brings us. Wisdom does not mean intellect. It does not mean intelligence. It does not mean collecting knowledge. Wisdom is how to apply what you know in the experiences that you're facing, how to navigate the experiences that you're facing. We might say now that wisdom is more than book smart. It is street smart. How many of you are street smart here this morning? Good, only a couple of you. That's okay. That's all right. It's my job to help you become more street smart. That's the real trouble here today. So the fallen, evil, unjust, broken world that has damaged our lives, James is going to help us navigate it. Okay, let's look together at James chapter 1. We're going to read 12 verses, verses 1 to 12, which is probably 13 verses. Is that right? It doesn't matter. 1 to 12, let's read it together. This letter is from James, a slave of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. I am writing to the 12 tribes, Jewish believers scattered abroad. Greetings. Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles of any kind come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. For you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow. For when your endurance is fully developed, you will be perfect and complete, needing nothing. If you need wisdom, ask our generous God and he will give it to you. He will not rebuke you for asking. But when you ask him, Be sure that your faith is in God alone. Do not waver, for a person with divided loyalty is as unsettled as a wave of the sea and is blown and tossed by the wind. Such people should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Their loyalty is divided between God and the world, and they are unstable in everything they do. Believers who are poor have something to boast about, for God has honored them. And those who are rich should boast that God has humbled them. They will fade away like a flower in the field. The hot sun rises and the grass withers. The little flower droops and falls, and its beauty fades away. In the same way, the rich will fade away with all of their achievements. God blesses those who patiently endure testing and temptation. And afterward, they will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. So number one, here's the idea. I'm gonna give you one I'm gonna propose one truth to you that we learn in this passage, and then two specific ways in which we apply those, okay? One concept, one truth, one kind of a theme, and then two specific applications for them. And here it is. The theme is, consider your troubling circumstances. When you think about them, when you have a view of your troubling circumstances, change the way you think of them and see them as an opportunity for joy. This is a shift in how you think. It's a shift in how you approach the trouble in your life. It's a shift in the way you interpret what's happening to you. If you thought the way God thought and you saw the way God saw, you would see circumstances that trouble you as an opportunity for joy. And the reason why that's important is because it is natural and ungodly to see all of our trouble as a means by which we look for someone to blame. That is instinctive in us. It is natural for us, and outside of God changing our view and our outlook, every time we experience trouble, we immediately and instinctively think, who's to blame? It can't be me, by the way. It's gotta be someone else. So I'm gonna find that person. I'm gonna name that person. Secondly, we often instinctively and naturally interpret our trouble in this way. It causes us to see it as an opportunity, or we actually experience the opportunity for bitterness. Blame eventually turns into bitterness. Someone else did this to me. This is unjust. This is unfair. I did not have this coming. I don't want trouble. I don't deserve trouble. And therefore, over time, bitterness takes root in us, and we struggle with blame and bitterness, all based on the way we interpret our trouble. And thirdly, oftentimes by nature, it ends up being an opportunity to bail out on our faith. To say things like, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I gave it a good run, that Christian faith thing, but didn't really work. So I have trouble. This trouble must mean that God is not with me, or he's not alive, or not real, or not good, so I'm out, and we bail. So blame, bitterness, bailing out in our faith, all those things happen instead of what God says. And God says, if you're a believer, if you belong to me, the trouble you're experiencing is actually an opportunity for you to experience joy that you wouldn't have experienced if this trouble didn't come your way. Can you think of times in your life where you were more dependent, closer to God, more in tune and in need because of the trouble that had visited your life? Anyone ever sit at a funeral and think, I gotta get my act together? I mean, I have got to get my act together. Or I have got to really think, pray, and consider and depend on God, because if I don't, I'm out of strength. I'm out of wisdom. I don't know what's gonna happen. I'm gonna come apart at the seams. But during that trouble, you found yourself more dependent, deeper in your faith, more in tune, alert, and aware of how God is at work in you and around you. There's no wonder that's happening. It's because opportunity for joy is in the middle of every bit of trouble. And by the way, keep in mind that James writes, when you experience, when troubles of any kind come your way. Did you notice here he doesn't say, now if troubles come your way, and they probably won't because you're a believer, you're a Christian, and you're a really good one, probably. So if you're a really good one and you're kind of built your resume, God will notice, and you will go from his naughty list to his nice list, and so only good things are happening. Now, we don't think that sarcastically the way I said it, but we believe that sincerely in our hearts. And what James is teaching us here is this. He says, when, not if, we should expect trouble. Yes? We should anticipate trouble. And if trouble is visiting you, it's not because God is asleep at the switch. It's not because he's taken the hands off the cosmic wheel of the universe or because he has stepped down from the throne of our lives. We should expect it. And by the way, what kind of trouble should we expect? He says, many troubles, various kinds. I categorize them for you: depression, disruption, disaster, disease, divorce, death. And he urges readers to gladly receive these that wash into our lives, since they will produce perseverance, steadfastness, maturity. They will produce in you a depth of character that is unique, that comes only from difficult things. Life is hard, but these troubles produce endurance. They shape your character. And some of you know this instinctively because you watch your kids struggling when they're young and they say things like, why do I have to have a job? None of my friends have a job. And plus, I'm so close to the high score on Fortnite. And this job is going to interrupt my plans for today, right? And now most of us know that a job builds what? Character. Not only does it build it, by the way, you also notice that that work reveals character. It's kind of like a double-edged sword there. But we force young people to work and do for themselves because it's good for them. It grows maturity, even though they say, this troubles me. I don't feel like doing this. I don't want to do this. But we've learned over time that even though it doesn't feel right, even though it isn't pleasant at the time, in the end, you are a better person for working. I remember when someone was asking, and I believe I've mentioned this before, but I should do the research on this. But there is a well-known, internationally renowned tycoon who it might be one of the hotel families. I want to say maybe the Hiltons or the Marriott family or whatever. They asked the one who started it all. They asked him, and they said, so. Are you, as you're facing the end stage of your life here, are you planning to hand off your fortune to your kids? And he said, no, I would never do that. And the interviewer pressed that, and he said, no. Why would I ruin their lives by giving them all of the money that I had to work for? In other words, without them working the way that I worked, it would ruin their lives to receive without earning it. And now I say all that to say, we've learned this and accepted this in our work life. God uses this, and God thinks this way, and God believes this to be true about hardship in our life when it's not related to our work, but it's related to hardship and trouble in our life, that it's good for us to be troubled. And that's counterintuitive, right? Because we think that, as parents, there's so many examples of this, but as parents, I think it's very, very, I think we actually have named it. When parents do not let their kids suffer, we have a word for it. It's called spoiling them, right? They don't just get what they want. They have a spoiled attitude. Can you make the transition? God, as our loving parent, does what's best for us. He lets us be troubled. He lets us come up short. He lets us hurt. He lets us feel the hardship and the stress of an evil, difficult, fallen world. And this is the reason. The reason is because God has an objective for our lives. And his objective, ultimately, his supreme objective for our lives, make sure you get this, it's not for us to live happy. It's instead for us to live holy. Our objective is to be happy people. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of trouble? No. Pursuit of stress? No. Pursuit of trials? No. Pursuit of hardship? Of course not. To pursue happiness. If you're an American Christian, this is your objective, to be happy. And if you get it wrong, God is there to help you be happy. That's not his ultimate supreme objective for your life. His objective is to build into us holiness, not happiness. And that is a tough one to accept. Now, in church on Sunday, it's an easy one to nod about. That's right, Pastor. What I would have said if I were you, that is well said. Agreed. We all agree, right? But haven't you discovered that once that dark cloud blows in, we we have legitimate questions about where God is in this trouble, whether or not he really cares, whether or not he's present, whether or not he exists. Why? It's because in our hearts, we've been convinced that the ultimate objective, and God helps this happen, we think, is to be happy. And what we learn in the scripture is that the way God views it is this: he saves your soul and secures you for eternity, and in the meantime, he is working to cause holiness in our lives, not just happiness. Is he glorified when we're joyful? Of course he is. But what he's saying is that the circumstances of our life shouldn't affect the depth of our joy. That's what he's teaching us here. That's what he's teaching us. And keep this in mind, that this is the same approach. Now, if you could imagine God is like a supreme physical therapist. In other words, pain always should, in God's view, should bring progress. Pain should bring progress. I'll never forget my first visit to physical therapy when I injured my hand in a freak incident that occurred as trouble befell me. Remember earlier I was talking about consequences of your ignorance versus there were some consequences in my life. I made a mistake and my snowblower bit my hand. And I had to go to therapy, and at hand therapy, my hand is swollen, my joints are broken to pieces, my bones are broken in my first few fingers, and I'm at hand therapy, and the hand specialist grabs my hand and very gently begins to invoke all kinds of holy hell on me. And all she does is just start to use my hand the way it's supposed to be and bend the joints where they're supposed to bend. And in a room full of people, I shot up out of my chair and spun like this. And then I looked around at everybody who was still seating and thought I should probably be sitting down during this, sat back down. And then she gives it another crank, and this time I let out a little, yike, wow. And then I had to know, does everybody do this? Please tell me. Am I a baby? She said, oh, no. No, the nerves in the hands is one of the worst pain that you could experience in the human body. I was like, thank God. Thank God I'm not a weenie. I was so concerned, so troubled. I didn't see anybody else dying on the table. She cranked that thing and cranked that thing. And here's what I noticed. The next time I visited, there's more mobility, less pain. My physical therapist kept at it and kept the trouble pressure on my hand because pain in her mind was progress. The more pain, the more progress. And over time, I had more functionality, and in the long run, I was better off at the end of physical therapy than I was before, even though it was painful all the way. Pain is progress. That's the way God sees it. He gives us an opportunity for joy during our suffering and during our troubling circumstances. And he does so to help us get unstuck. Imagine if God is kind of like a physical therapist and he only wants you to be comfortable, he's allowing you to be stuck. He allows you to get stuck right there, immobile. He limits what you can do in your life. And by the way, if you have a physical therapist, when you start to express it's uncomfortable and they say, well, let's not press it, let's not push it, find a new physical therapist, right? Secondly, God uses the trouble in our lives to test our faith. James tells us not only is he at work causing us holiness instead of happiness, he is also at work through these troubles testing our faith. What is he testing for? Listen to this. He's testing us during trouble to find out if our faith is real or not. If it's real, it'll endure. It'll persevere. If it's not real, here's what we'll say. We'll say, you know what? This philosophy, not this faith, because faith would be resting your confidence in a sovereign, compassionate, all-knowing shepherd king who rules over my life, and whatever he wants, I accept. That's called faith. But what the trouble does is the trouble forces us to decide if that's really faith, we live like that, is this what we believe, or is, in fact, what we have signed up for more of a philosophy. I like to call it a life enhancement philosophy. The Christian faith, a life enhancement policy, meaning, or a life enhancement philosophy, meaning this, that God desires, and this is the purpose of our faith, to help you and make sure that you live your best life now. A life enhancement philosophy. That if I do good and I bring God into my life, he's gonna make good things happen for me. I'm gonna get healthier and I'm going to certainly get wealthier. Things are gonna be more convenient, less trouble, more ease and happiness, right? And so when trouble comes, it helps test whether or not we have the real thing or if we just have a philosophy that over the course of our trouble, you add up a few of those and you go, you know what, I'm not living my best life now. I'm not really experiencing the health and wealth and happiness that I had hoped for and wanted and expected in the Christian faith. Don't you know people like this? And they say, nah, I'm really, it's not working for me. I always think in the back of my mind when I hear this, of course it's not working for you. That's not how it works. This is not a philosophy that you install into your life. So as Christians, we're to think about these troubles in light of what God is achieving in us through them. And we are to get this, to cherish the idea, the prospect, the possibilities of a deeper life and a richer faith. And that's what we're aiming for. Now, my mom spent years in a nursing home and she had a physical therapist that she had to see on a regular basis. And my mom, after years and years and years of physical therapy at the nursing home, showed some incredible progress. I used to ask her about her physical therapist and my mom would say, "You mean physical torturist?" Yeah, how is your physical therapy going? My mom would always tell stories of how her physical torturist would force her into painful positions. And at first she said, "I don't want to go see her. I don't want to go to my appointment. I think I have the flu." But over time, my mom's physical therapist would say, and I would ask her, "How's it going? Is there progress?" And she said, "Well, don't forget, not long ago when your mom came in here, we had to help her out of her bed, put her in a wheelchair, we wheeled her all the way down here. Now, I understand, she just told me that she walked herself from her room down to the end of the sidewalk into your car so that you could take her to Gannon's for some homemade ice cream." I said, "Yes, praise the Lord." And she said, "That is what we call progress. She's not stuck. She's not sick, she's not immobile, she's no longer stranded in her own bed. But through the hardship and the pain and the suffering of putting her in positions that are painful, she is now free to move and function and live more healthy and receive the divine inspiration and the divine hand of God in the form of a small single scoop chocolate peanut butter. Or peppermint patty, it's a tie." And this is happening because my mother finds herself in a situation now where because of this, weeks later, she's now able to persevere all the way to the car. And before she couldn't persevere. And see, this is what God does. He tests your faith and says, is it real? And if it's real, what does it do? It perseveres. It builds steadfastness. You keep on going. Some of you might be runners or into physical fitness, and you know the more you work, the more you run, what happens? The further you go. And this is what God does for us. Trials, troubles, and the more you experience, the further you go, the more you build up. So how should we face this turmoil? How should we face it? How should believers face today's trial? Let me give you two things real quick. Two things. Number one, talk to God and listen for his wisdom. So in trouble, here's the opportunity for joy. We spend more time talking to God, more time listening for his wisdom. The wisdom that you need for the trouble that you're facing is in God's book, and it's in his spirit as he's speaking to us in prayer and reading in the scriptures. That what we need in our lives comes from God. If you need wisdom, just ask God. He's generous. He gives liberally to you. Every trouble is an opportunity to pray for wisdom that comes from above, not from our friends, family, and coworkers. God's wisdom for your trouble on how to handle the poverty that you're facing, the wealth that you've just inherited, Some of that wisdom is packed up. We've got it available for you in the Financial Peace University. It's God's wisdom in the principles being taught by Dave Ramsey in that university and how to handle your wealth and battle out of and through poverty. God's wisdom for your trouble in how to navigate the end stages of life and teaching your kids to how to face death and what are the eternal priorities and values that go on and on. How to sort through marriage and family crisis. It's all in the Bible. The wisdom of God from God comes to you through his word and through prayer and people that he provides to you. And when you ask him, you ask in faith, and that faith that you have is in God. It's not in how much faith you have. When you're in prayer, you're not placing your faith in how intense you are. You know that God doesn't hear you clearer the more intense and loud you get. Did you know that? Isn't that a, I'm so glad about that. He doesn't need you to holler at him in order for him to hear you and respond to you. And also, God doesn't respond to you because you're trusting in your resume, right? You don't do more good things, and then when you're praying, remind God of how much you have done for him and how long you have faithfully lived with him in order for him to answer. No, it is faith in God alone that he's capable, he desires to, and he certainly is a loving heavenly father. And when we pray like that, we can pray without doubting. The premise of doubt, by the way, is that my desires are more good than God's desires. Secondly, how should believers face today's trials? Trust God and persevere for what? For his reward. There is a reward ahead. There is a reward for everybody who endures, everybody whose faith is authentic, everybody who finally finishes this journey called life. There is a reward. Look at how it's stated here in verse 12. God blesses those who patiently do what? Endure. What are they enduring? Temptation and testing. Jesus did it. We're asked to do it. Afterward, when? Right now? No, afterward, at the end, when it's over, when it's all said and done on this earth, and it's appointed unto man to die and face judgment, at that time there is a reward that occurs, and afterward, after our life is over, we receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him. Now, I always pictured, when this verse kind of hit me, I always thought of this big, huge crown. I mean, my crown's going to be, it's going to be pretty big. What about yours? It's going to be pretty big. It's gonna be like this. I always pictured it as like this just royal, eternal size bling, and we've got the jewels on there. And I often joke that when somebody does something good, that you can imagine that what you just did, you're gonna get a whole new big old jewel right for that crown. Now, keep this in mind. What James is writing here is not a royal crown of authority. It's a different crown. This crown that he's describing is the crown that you would give someone who just won the race. It's more like a wreath indicating that this is a champion who's finished first, who overcame all the obstacles. It would be often worn by an emperor who was victorious in battle and had overcome all of the enemy's attacks, and they won the battle. They get the crown of life, meaning they are the champion who's finished the race. They've overcome all of the obstacles in the way, and in the end, you've won. Well done, good and faithful servant. Your faith endured to the end. Here's the crown of life. The reward that God offers us for patiently enduring is an eternity with Jesus. No more sorrow, no more tears, no more suffering, no more sin, only joy, only satisfaction, only fullness. And even though you may still be facing depression now, you say things like, I'm still running. Even though you may be facing today disruption in your life, you say, I'm still praying. Even though you may be facing disaster, you're saying, I'm still trusting. Even though the doctor may have said you have this disease, it doesn't really matter to you because you are saying out loud by faith, I'm never quitting. I will finish the race. Divorce, I'm gonna finish the race. Death, it don't matter, I'm gonna finish the race. Why? Because I am more dependent, more reliant, more trusting, more hope-filled that my God knows what he's doing and my God is shaping me into who he wants me to be. And I'm going to be more mature now than I was before. I'm gonna have a better perspective. How about this one? One day I'm gonna wear the winner's crown and that's the reward I'm aiming for. I don't need the raise, I don't need the physical health, I don't need anything here. I know that my reward is in heaven.